Introduction, but I'll do so anyway. Sorry, I have to stand on my tippy toes to get in line with the microphone. The first session will be by Chris and Jean Deanna. And Jean Deanna, of course, is the head of recorded sound at the Library of Congress, and I'm sure all of you know him very well. Chris Lisinic is the founder of Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, a consulting firm that works internationally with organisations including the Library of Congress, Carnegie Hall, the Museum of Modern Art, and Stanford University. He's a former Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Vidipax, a moving image and sound preservation reformatting facility, and he served as an adjunct professor in New York University's Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Master's Degree Program since 2004. Passionate advocate for the advancement of the field, as I'm sure you all know, he lectures and sits on advisory boards, chairs committees, and active in standards forming and other relevant organisations, including the ARSC Technical Committee. So without further ado, I am going to pull up Jean's presentation, because Jean is going to start this, and I will hand over.
Thank you. Are we up? Great. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a great conference, George. Thank you. I'm really here to introduce Chris by way of presenting the work of my colleagues in the National Digital Information Infrastructure Preservation Program that is under the Office of Strategic Initiatives at the Library of Congress. So I'm presenting their work to get Chris up here to talk more about what he's doing. The Federal Agency's Digitization Guidelines Initiative was launched in 2007 under the auspices of the NDIIPP program at the Library of Congress, and not surprisingly, the main emphasis is digitization. There are two working groups. The Still Image Group is concerned with scanning guidelines for books, photos, maps, while the Audiovisual Group looks at guidelines for recorded sound and moving images. It's a collaborative effort with participation from 18 federal agencies. Yes, the federal government agencies can collaborate with each other. The audio work is prominent at the U.S. National Archives, the Voice of America, the Smithsonian Institution, and at the Library of Congress, we have two divisions working in audio as part of the project. My area at the Packard Campus for Audiovisual Conservation, and the folks over at the American Folklife Center. Both of the working groups seek to develop guidelines that are comparable from agency to agency for the sake of uniformity and to make it easier for vendors to provide equipment and services. And the work of the group is building on earlier work produced by ARISC and YAZA, the Sound Directions Project, Engineers Roundtable, organized by the National Recording Preservation Board, and others, we're all familiar with. Now, for recorded sound, the two main areas of current emphasis are metadata embedding and digital system performance. I'm just going to highlight a few things about these and then turn it over in a moment to Chris Lisinic, who's been the working group's expert consultant for audio, and he'll cover them in much, much greater detail and expertise. Embedded metadata is never all there is. In every archive, it works at some level of synergy with metadata and databases, catalogs. Why have it? Well, if you distribute files, at least some metadata will go with the object. And in a preservation repository, embedded metadata gives you that safety information to help identify files and support disaster recovery. Now, the FAGI guideline covers the BEX chunk in broadcast wave, standardized by the European Broadcast Union. And version 2 of that standard was published in 2011. And we want to stay in sync with that, so we published version 2 of our guideline this year. And I should point out that the FAGI webpage dedicated to the guidelines also has three background documents that provide an explanatory context for the guidelines and describe the constraints imposed by existing WAVE metadata structures. So I recommend those three background documents to you. Now, the FADGI, or FAGI, guideline deviates from the EBU standard, however, by recommending an approach that permits the file to contain multiple identifiers. The guideline goes beyond BEXT as well, suggesting an optional use for the RIF info chunk, part of the basic WAV file structure, to increase the extent of metadata that can be embedded. In a moment, Chris is going to demonstrate his BWF meta edit, and it's an open source tool he developed for FADGI to make it easy to edit the metadata in the WAV file. System performance has two facets. The first looks at A to D converters and explores pass-fail metrics. How good does the device need to be for preservation work? The only real statement on this topic is in YASA TC04. And how ought we make our measurements? Well, Chris's effort yielded the new FADGI recommendation, similar to, but a little different from the YASA guideline. And it's worth saying that these recommendations, these pass-fail recommendations, I should say, are for the high-end digitization of the most exacting type. The working group also plans to look at relaxed specifications for some materials, and also to support more modestly equipped small archives. The second facet for system performance concerns interstitial errors, the little dropouts that may happen when the audio workstation actually writes the file to media. Some field tests are now underway in two federal agency audio labs, one of them at the Packard campus, to assess this problem, and we expect to report about these tests later in the year. And now, here's Chris Lesinek to talk more. Thank you very much.
I got it. Well, thank you, Gene. And thanks, everybody, for coming. It would be a travesty if I did not mention, before I got off the stage, Carl Fleischauer, whose work within the Federal Agency's Digitization Guidelines Initiative has been extremely significant. he's really been the brains behind a lot of the work that's happened, and I've been lucky enough just to be there to work with him and with others like Kate Murray from National Archives and a number of other very talented people within that group. So, you're not seeing my presentation. How can we, I'm doing a PDF actually, so it's not the, I need to take it off of, or put it onto mirror mode, I guess. Apologies. So, well, I can start talking about it while we get this going. So, it's a very unfortunate acronym, FADGI, however, there's a number of ways that people say it. And it's too long to say the whole thing. So, but the project that we worked on, I'm gonna talk about three projects today, which Gene talked about. BWF Meta Edit, I'm gonna show you some of the updates and kind of give an overview of what it does. We'll talk about the Interstitial Error Project and the audio analog to digital converter performance testing. There's an overarching goal with all three of these projects, and it is to address, to basically address needs. I'm just going to view full screen mode. Oh yeah, a couple more down. No, you were in the right. Full screen mode, three more down. One more, there you go, yep. All right, so I'll crane my neck over here. Why? But thank you very much, by the way. So the project goals were to do something that was simple, low cost, which is a relative term, right? But thinking about small archives that aren't as well resourced as some larger organizations, and addressing needs that were represented within the federal agencies group, but that they thought would have an impact on the field at large. So these are very much kept in mind in the things that we talk about, and I think I'll highlight some of those things. So the three projects I mentioned already are noted by these three icons that we'll talk about, which I just made up for the purpose of this presentation. So first, I'll talk about BWF Meta Edit. So BWF is a standard. It plays off of standard WAV file format and basically injects what's called the BEXT chunk into a WAV file. And the BEXT chunk is just a small number of fields. It gives us a little bit of metadata to embed in the file to travel along with it. So this is a demonstration. Up top we see actual BWF meta edit interface, and there's much more to the right, and there's other screens and stuff, but this gives you a sense that essentially what we see in the interface is what is in the header of the file. Now it actually gives you access to more than just the BEXT chunk. There's other types of chunks. This is another funny term that we use when we talk about WAV files and AVI files that are RIF based, this word chunk. But essentially gives you access to that metadata that's in there. So there's a few things we can do with that. One is we can embed. So here we see, you know, essentially a blank screen. We can take either a CSV, which can be open, edited in spreadsheet applications like Excel, and you can do all kinds of automated operations in there. You know, people are familiar with that interface. You can also feed it an XML file and batch embed metadata in files. You can also edit, so you can open up files and you can just use the interface to actually edit in the file, or you could bring it in, export the metadata into a spreadsheet application or XML, edit it, and re-embed it, essentially editing it. So there we see in the interface here is where you could actually open it up and alter something. So you've got an interface for entering in a value there, or this is the spreadsheet application or XML that you could edit and re-embed. And lastly, an important one, extract. So you can actually get the metadata out of the file or parse it out, again, as either CSV or XML to have data interchange with other systems or to run various processes. So one of the main changes, I should also mention that there, what I showed there was the GUI or graphical user interface. There is also command line versions, and it's cross-platform for virtually every operating system you can think of. There's a version for. So, what? DOS, yeah, I'll do that one for you, George. All right, no more comments from George Blood. All right, so EBU Tech 3285 is the EBU standard that describes what BWF is, and version 2 brings what it brings to the table are these loudness values. Now, as Gene mentioned, loudness doesn't necessarily have a lot of applicability to this group here. It's primarily used by broadcasters to help meet legislation about how loud things can be broadcast. So they have things that embed metadata, and then they have software and hardware that looks at the embedded metadata and adjusts according to the values that are in this. So like Gene said, the value in bringing it up to speed is to make sure that we're staying current. And this shows that we can do that. We can embed and edit that metadata, but there aren't a lot of use cases in the library and archives context at this point. I'll just show off a couple other things quickly. One is in the latest release, just a nice interface for entering in UMIDs, unique material identifier, and these are used by a large range of people, mostly in commercial contexts. So they're fairly complex to generate. The interface gives you the ability to generate them within it and be compliant with UMID standard. Coding history. So this is within the BEXT chunk, a field which really what we're doing is talking about what's happened. Who kind of, you know, it says at the top here, it started off as an analog stereo. I can't read what I'm saying. Going from memory here, but analog stereo, I think it says it was reproduced on a Studer A807, and then we created a PCM 96 kilohertz 24-bit file, and then we created a derivative from that. So it's our provenance. It tells us about the history of the file, and again, a lot of people have been entering this in manually, or some software will automatically inject its own interpretation of this, But here we actually have an interface that has controlled vocabularies and various things so that it helps people enter it in and code it correctly according to the recommendations. Another really key thing that I love is that it has an audio-only MD5. So for, I don't know if that means something to everybody in here. An MD5 is a type of a checksum, which is kind of a fingerprint for a file, and it speaks to data integrity. So if you create an MD5 and anything changes, when you go to create that MD5 again, you will get a different value. If nothing has changed, you will get the same value, thus you know that nothing has changed and you have integrity. So the problem with doing that at the file level is that we do want to change things purposefully, like metadata in the header. So here what we've done is we're ignoring the header and we're looking at only the audio data, and we're creating an MD5 just for the audio data in the file so that people can continue to change metadata and we can verify just the audio. In the other case where the whole file changes, it's not very effective at telling you whether there's been an alteration otherwise. So this allows you to embed that in the file, the checksum value, but also export it via CSV or XML. So I'm going to move on to the next one. But before I move on, I should also mention that the application is free, open source. It's on SourceForge. Anybody can download it. It's actually been downloaded about 5,500 times. It's used internationally by organizations ranging from large broadcasters to small historical societies. It's in really wide use and widely adopted. So now I'm going to talk about a study that's taking place that's resulted in a recent publication and a guideline that's forthcoming. And this is about analog to digital conversion performance testing. So there's an issue that occurs with performance testing in that we only have very complex test methods. We looked out of the Audio Engineering Society, AES 17, which is referenced up here, for instance. It's stuff that requires, one, very specialized equipment, and two, a fairly high level of expertise that's specialized as well, and it's not applicable to the work that, reformatting work, that most people that are managing these efforts and doing quality control can really deal with. The goal of this project was to come up with, one, performance metrics and test methods for doing this work, but two, with the idea, the longer vision of having an actual hardware and software solution that could be used to perform these things that was, again, low cost, simple, could be used by non-experts to do simple quality control, either internally if an organization is doing their own reformatting work, they can test their own A to D converter. If they were outsourcing work to a vendor, they could tell the vendor, I want you to follow this test method, deliver me the files when you deliver me my content, and the user or the client in that case will have a piece of software that they can hit go, and it will get a pass fail. Yes, this either meets the specs or not. And for those that are more technically inclined, they can dig behind the scenes and see what's going on in a detailed view. That's the vision. This doesn't exist yet. Don't get excited. So the first thing we had to do was, guess what? There's test methods, and they have no performance metrics. So this means there are things we can go to AES and IEC, which are standards forming bodies, and they have very great detailed stuff about how to perform a test. So it tells you, what frequency do you want to do it at? How long do you want to do it? What exactly do you want to do? How do you do all this stuff? But it doesn't tell you anything about how to interpret the value that you get out of that, right? So on the flip side, we have EASA TC04, which gives us some values. They say, and we call those values performance metrics. They say an analog to digital converter should meet these specifications. But there are implied test methods for some and no test methods for others. So it leaves us in a little bit of a quandary about how we actually close that gap and do this thing. So the first step was to reconcile these two things, which is represented up here. And in some cases, we found that we had test methods with no recommended performance specification. In other cases, we found we had performance specs with no test methods. And we also wanted to throw one of the goals of this was to define, what are the key performance metrics? What are the important things that we want to find? So we cast a fairly broad net, and we threw a lot of tests into the mix, and we wanted to see, As we look across multiple converters that are represent different price points, and what we did was we used a collection of five converters that are actually used throughout the federal agencies, just to have a reference point to use, because otherwise you could spend lots of hours deciding which ones to pick. And you want to see how things plot out over time. Where are the big changes in things and you know various converters? So we came up with eventually our test method and the associated performance specs. And in some cases, you know, where we had a test method but no performance spec, we said, well, after we run the tests, let's see what we get, and we'll see what the critical points are and thresholds, and see if we can make a determination there. We also anticipated that we would find that there were things that we thought were important in the beginning that weren't, or that there were things that we just didn't know whether they would be or not, and we may keep them or throw them out. So we, like I said, we took the test suite. We actually performed these tests with five different converters, all different price points, different reputations, as much of a variety as we could capture in five A to D converters. And we got the results from those. We took the results and we looked at them and we kind of plotted it all out and analyzed it. And what we did was we came up with what we thought was the core, where were the really core things that we needed to keep. And I'll say that while I am an audio engineer and I know quite a bit about audio engineering, I'm not a test and measurement expert. That's an expertise all into its own, and I conferred quite a bit with the Audio Engineering Society Standards Committee on test and measurement throughout this, and there were a couple of key people that I should mention, actually Ian Dennis from Prism and Richard Cabot from Qualys. But the group at large kind of helped me figure out, and so one of the things that was challenging was, when you get any group of experts in a room, like if a bunch of transfer experts we got in a room, we said, all right, guys, what's the really important stuff? And everybody throws their important thing on the table, you end up with a giant, giant basket of there's someone in the room that thinks if you don't do that, you're an idiot. And other people think that, you take it or leave it. So we kind of ended up with, we had to make some judgment calls, and we used the data to figure out what was actually holding water with people's judgments on that. Ultimately, we made some decisions, we provided the rationale, we talked about what our process is, and we came up with this published document. And these are just some snapshots. I got the 5-minute warning, so I gotta get through this stuff. I got one more thing to talk about. So you can read this all, it's on digitizationguidelines.gov. We posted this and asked for comments, and we got a few great comments. As Jean mentioned, we're going to do next. The next thing is we're going to come up with performance levels. This represents the highest. And one of the frustrations and challenges, and one of the things we got comments on, was actually meeting that original goal. We ended up with something that, again, was still so specialized. And once we got in the stuff that people said was really critical, it was still looking like an expensive tool. So we want to come up with levels, try to get costs down, but I also think about taking a different approach, which is coming from, we're kind of taking a top-down approach. I'm interested in looking at this from bottom up and saying, kind of taking a more rogue approach and saying, if there were three things we were going to do and we have to keep this at a certain price point, what are those three things? And I think that will be better than what we have now because it's practical and doable. So the last thing is interstitial errors. This is errors that occur as the audio is being written to disk. So this is post analog to digital conversion, post sound card in the computer. It often happens as the file is actually being written to disk. And what usually happens is missing samples. So that's what we see here. This steep vertical is actually representing where samples are missing. And it's a system resource allocation issue. The computer has lots of things to do. It's monitoring the network, it's monitoring system resources, it's doing various things. And when it walks away from putting priority on audio and comes back, you end up with missing samples. I'm not gonna go through all this, but I will say we did a lot of work a ways back. on saying, what does this thing look like? What hardware would you need? What software would you need? What would it do? What do we really, what would it really take to, we did wireframe mock-ups to say, kind of look at what the interface of such a tool would look like that would address this and how it would act, what type of reports it would output, and ultimately a work plan. So this would inform either what we hoped would be someone could take this and run with a grant proposal for a research and development grant to, say, an NEH to build this tool, or a commercial entity could look at this, figure out whether there's a business case or not, and potentially take this and run with it. We also did a survey as part of that to try to figure out, is there a business case? We got 83 respondents, 75 said they were interested in the solution to this, with some people who said we were out of our minds, this was a non-issue, and that we should go do something else with our time. Relatively few of those, but you know, keeps it interesting. So oddly enough, there were 56 people who said they had previously experienced or were aware of these issues. 75 wanted it, so I guess they want it either way. But so now we're actually doing this. We're doing a little pilot to quantify the extent of this issue. So we've got a device that we're putting in three different organizations for 3 to 4 weeks at a time. We're capturing, we're going into this device, this UFX device, which has a USB direct to disk. I can tell you why more about why we're taking this approach if anybody is interested. After, but what we do is we end up having two files. It's the same file. So we take a digital splitter and we record both files. We then compare them to each other. And if there's any variances between them, then we get a notification and we know. So we'll have a test set of data of about 9 to 12 weeks of recording in three different organizations with three different setups. And we're going to see, does this happen zero times? Does it happen once? Does it happen thousands of times? And try to figure out, again, build the business case and see really how critical this is. And this is just an image of the device. And it's set up, there's two drives. It's very low impact. It's just this little blue device that the cable is coming out of with a red drive on top of it and another up above. And that is it. Thank you.
I know Chris has to jump on a plane very shortly, so does anyone have a couple of quick questions for Chris or Jean?
Yes.
Are you guys working on any recommendations for environmental conditions in which to operate the equipment?
Yeah, well, that was one of the things that came up. This project came about because people within the federal agencies had encountered this issue and had said, yeah, you know, we've noticed this, it's a problem. And that was one of the first things that came up. So historically, people say, well, some of the people that said it's a non-issue said, well, if you just buy the right equipment, you spend enough money, it's not a problem. Empirical data says that that's not quite true. Other people say, well, yeah, get off the internet, don't have this, don't have that, set your drivers this way. And that's how I came up in audio engineering. You don't do any of that stuff. However, we found that even in those circumstances that this can happen, and that approach requires, you know, basically knowledge of every operating system, every driver configuration, it's in many ways kind of a way more resource intensive thing. So this looks at trying to be more systemic and just looking at the output and saying, regardless of what's going on, it may be an issue you can address or not, but this makes you aware of the issue.
I was just thinking about things like
yeah, it all definitely matters, all of that stuff.
In your project, you have been reporting, both of you have been reporting, that you are thinking of relaxing the A to D converter standard set by YASA DC04 to make the equipment more affordable, obviously, for small institutions. What is the order of financial order of magnitude which you are thinking about? Which would justify such a relaxation?
Yeah, so I have a couple responses to that. One is the financial relaxation that I talked about was on the device for testing things, but it is directly tied to the relaxation or what we call performance levels. So what we talk about here is we have things that nobody would deny are very in need of very high performance, right? We have music that's recorded on half-inch tape at 30 inches per second, recorded with great microphones, great conditions, undoubtedly really needs the highest performance level. If we impose that same thing on people with audio cassettes and of oral history collections that have, you know, as George said, what's the software, the open source, Audacity and $500 to spend on an A to D converter, well, you know what, that's not useful to them. So we, in recognizing that there are, in fact, probably very realistic performance levels that we can use to address different types of content, and we're not going to say necessarily what that content is. That's up. That's the judgment of the person or the person who's going to use these tools. But I think we're simply recognizing that it's a reality.
Well, I accept the testing and the easiness of using these tools, but I would like to refer you all to the fact that we have learned in digitizing. Poor audio signals, that the worse the signal, the better we need the resolution to possibly improve the quality or to for restoration and things like that.
Yes.
So again, I say if there is not a substantial financial advantage in it, I would at least emotionally be against
it. Yeah, so I would say that's a good point. I would say your argument I would not agree with on the basis of technological circumstances alone. If it's valuable and low quality, by all means, throw your best equipment at it. If it's lower value and poor quality, then maybe it's okay to use something that's lower end.